This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Governor Deval Patrick made an impassioned plea today for the state to help the flood of children crossing the U.S.-Mexico border.
Twice he came to the edge of tears as he called on Massachusetts to accept up to 2,000 of the unaccompanied children who've illegally entered the United States.
Every major faith tradition on the planet charges its followers to treat others as we ourselves wish to be treated. I don't know what good there is in faith if we can't and won't turn to it in moments of human need.
Patrick said two facilities in the state, Camp Edwards in Bourne and Westover Air Base in Chicopee, could be used to house the children, but he said they would not be released into local communities.
The children who are coming are not free to move around. They are being processed under our law. And until that processing is complete, they need to be in one place that is secure.
Joining us now is WBUR's Asma Khalid, who was at the governor's announcement today. And Asma, a lot of emotion in that press conference. Tell us what the governor's actually proposing.
Well, I just want to give you a bit of a backstory for folks who may be catching up with this story. You know, the federal government has had a crisis at the border. There are thousands of children who have been illegally entering the United States from the U.S.-Mexico border. And really, you know, the border states are inundated. They're flooded and they don't have the capacity. Detention centers are overcrowded. And so the federal government asked Massachusetts for some help, and this is where, you know, we catch up to speed with today, where the governor proposed two possible sites, one in Western Mass and one on the Cape, that would potentially be able to temporarily house these children. The sites would be open for about 4 months, but the thinking is, on average, kids tend to process out of these facilities in about 35 days. He gave two sites, but in reality, he says that only one will be selected and they'll be able to house about up to 1,000.
So these two sites in Bourne and Chicopee, give us a sense. Do we know how will the children be held there? What will their lives be like while they're held?
You know, I don't think that we know very much about what their lives will exactly be like. I know that it's a secured site. They will not be allowed to leave. So, you know, any concerns about hospitals or public schools, say, in Chicopee that would be affected, I don't think that those are realistic concerns at this point. The children will be kept on site, and essentially they're supposed to be processed by immigration officials. They'll be either processed and deported or reunited with family or possibly be allowed to apply for asylum.
Asma, before we went on the air, you said this is the first time you saw the governor actually choke up. Obviously, an emotion that an issue that means a lot to him. Have others criticized it? Is there criticism about his proposal?
There is some criticism. I spoke actually earlier today. Don Humison, who's a state senator from Westfield, his district includes part of Chicopee, and he had a lot of concerns about the governor's proposal. He says that it injects Massachusetts into a much bigger debate about border security. You know, that these problems are not just limited now to the Southwest part of the state, but it's bringing these problems up to the Northeast. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
You know, at some point I'll be called or labeled a cold, heartless person for not wanting to reach out and care for the poor children of the Central American countries south of us, but so be it. I'll accept that. But my bigger concern is taking care of my own neighbors, my own taxpayers, my own citizens, and my own constituents. And that's what my job is, and that's what I have to be most concerned with doing.
So there's a political aspect to this as well, even though the governor isn't standing for re-election. What are the various candidates hoping to take his place? What do they have to say about this?
Well, they all very quickly offered statements of support to Governor Patrick's proposal. Steve Grossman was actually in the room. There were a number of immigration activists there, and he offered his support there in person. So I think, you know, while it may have this political tone, I think the governor was actually asked about that very point, and he simply said this isn't political. The crowd of immigration activists in the room cheered him on, and it seems that if a Democrat succeeds him, that this, you know, that same sort of rhetoric will carry on.
All right. WBR's Asma Khalid reporting on Governor Deval Patrick's press conference today. Thanks, Asma.
You're welcome.
We're going to pick up now with our Week in Review panel to talk more about the governor's immigration proposal and other top stories from this week. With us in the studio are Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, nice to have you back.
Good to be back.
And also Joan Vinaki, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, good to have you, too.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you. Let's start right up on Governor Patrick's decision on this immigration issue. Joan, I'll go to you first. I'd love just your response and what you make of the governor being really emotional about this. I mean, obviously, this is something he seems to be talking about from his heart.
No one should ever underestimate Governor Patrick's ability to be eloquent. Mm. That's his calling card. And I don't doubt that he really feels this very strongly. And he often says things aren't political and gets very indignant when people suggest that there is a political piece to
it. As he did today.
Right. And I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that there is politics involved here. And it is a lot easier for a governor who is not running for re-election, who is a Democrat, to take the stand. He also has the Pope on his side, which helps. And
yeah, we should mention
religious leaders were there as
well. Right, he was flanked by Cardinal Sean O'Malley and other religious leaders as well.
I think this is one of these, from a political standpoint, time will tell kind of stories. If this really develops into kind of a political wedge issue, there was mention of Steve Grossman being in the room and the Democrats supporting him. I don't know what Charlie Baker has had to say about it yet. It'll be interesting to see where the Republicans take this.
What do you think, Jim? You know, it runs counter to some of what the other New England governors are saying. Connecticut's Dan Malloy said flat out no. Vermont's Peter Shumlin said that he needs to look at the issue further. What do you think of the governor's decision?
Well, I think there is definitely politics involved and also kids involved. And I'd say that the debate so far has been, to some extent, debased. And I think the governor's use of, for example, the Holocaust and that sort of thing, that's over the top. But he is right to speak from the heart and to say, you know, this is a potentially temporary situation where there are kids who actually need a place to stay. I see absolutely nothing wrong with that. If they're here for a short period of time, they're not actually impacting public schools and that sort of thing, and the feds are paying for it and securing the facility, I see this as much ado about really not terribly much. What I would say is, from Malloy, as well as O'Malley in Maryland, as well as many other governors, the ground is shifting on this debate and shifting quickly, and it's largely because people around the country locally, for example, in Chicopee, look at this and say, gosh, not here, please. And that's a sort of NIMBY reaction, Democrat or Republican. But Democrats and Republicans around the country at the gubernatorial level are saying the feds are not doing their job. And I think they're absolutely right about that.
Jim, that Holocaust remark the governor made that you mentioned, he first said yesterday, and he made another version of that remark today. Here's what he said at his conference this morning.
Once in 1939, we turned our backs on Jewish children fleeing the Nazis. And it remains a blight on our national reputation. The point is that this good nation is great when we open our doors and our hearts to needy children, and diminished when we don't.
Now, the governor is getting pushback on that. There is one state rep, Steve Howitt, who is Republican and Jewish. He said that comparing Central America to Nazi Germany was, quote, ludicrous. It's about as loaded a historical analogy as a person can draw. Joan, do you think it's appropriate here to be invoking gas chambers?
I think it was a little bit over the top, but Governor Patrick didn't back down. In fact, he doubled down, which is again his MO.
Question for either of you, which is that, as we've mentioned, Governor Patrick is not running for re-election, at least for governor. He may be eyeing a different higher office in which immigration is even a bigger issue. But if that means that if this plan goes through, there is potentially a lot of work left behind for the Democratic Party in many ways. Where do you think that leaves the Democratic Party if this is what is going to be coming down the pipeline? Joan?
This being kids here in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Well, I don't think we know, because we don't know how long temporary is. We don't know what the plan is once they get here, how it's going to play out. I think it's a big question mark for whoever is the next governor.
Do you think the argument that it is not unreasonable to ask Massachusetts to pitch in is a rational one, that this isn't just a border state problem and now it needs to be shared evenly among all states?
Absolutely. We're part of the United States, and this is a United States border issue, and I think the federal government should be involved in this. And I think, frankly, whatever the governor does on this issue, he should take after this to be, I think, coherent, a stronger stand in terms of and articulate for the rest of the country where we should go on this issue. And he should get a bunch of different governors to actually talk about that across the aisle. I think this is an important one where, you know, there's a local guy who co-authored a book called If We Can Put a Man on the Moon. It was all about, why did Iraq happen, the financial meltdown, and Katrina? Why can't the federal government actually do something sizable, considerable, important, like it could do before? It's a really great question.
You could also ask, why can't the state step up for, there's lots of homeless kids in Massachusetts. In fact,
In motels?
Right, in motels, and the number has been growing. They haven't been able to solve that problem. And you couldn't muster the same group of people in the same room and get the same emotion and tears. Maybe you could, but I haven't seen it. So that's also a question.
That's right. All right. Well, let's move on to the issue of Haystack, which we talked about this week. So Haystack is a new app that launched this week in Boston. It allows people to essentially resell city-owned parking spaces. So, for example, if you're leaving a parking space, you tap on your app and you can sell your space to someone with the same app who's been circling the block desperate for a parking space. So we spoke to Eric Meyer. He's the founder of Haystack. He joined us on the show on Wednesday, and he portrayed this app as the next step in the shared economy. Here's what he said.
Let's say there's a neighbor who's parked for a completely legitimate reason, no reason to make money, but they are willing to inconvenience themselves for somebody who really, really is in desperate need of a spot. And we've all been in those situations before. And so then you can say, hey, I'm willing to move my car for $5 or $7 tonight if you really need a place to park.
Now, City Hall doesn't want anything to do with this. Here's Mayor Marty Walsh on Wednesday afternoon responding to Haystack.
You're talking a private company benefiting on public space. Interesting idea, but you can't sell public parking spaces, and you can't sell public spaces.
So the mayor rolling out the unwelcome mat there for this new app. Jim, we gave Eric Meyer a big chance to sort of talk about this. We didn't have really strong pushback to this. So I'm going to, just for the sake of this conversation, take the side on the mayor's side here. This does sound like, come on, are you kidding me? Making bucks off of taxpayer-funded public parking spaces? What am I missing here?
And I would largely agree with you, but let me present the other argument for a second. You know, Hiawatha Bray had a great piece where he said, look, we've actually created these shortages of spaces. It's because we've not done what San Francisco's done with adjustable meter rates depending on when there's demand. We've not actually had residents pay for parking the permits. And so we're basically inducing people, encouraging them to come into the city. We should do many more market-oriented things to make sure that we are making more space available. Now, Eric Meyer comes in. He says, look, as all entrepreneurs do, I've got a partial solution.
Yeah.
The problem is a partial solution to a public problem, yeah. Right? So I think, from my perspective, think about this for a second. You've got someone who works in a neighborhood, Alston, and that person's leaving work and says, hey, I've got a parking spot. And a resident comes in and says, I need a parking spot. Does that resident actually have to pay $5 to $7 to get a parking spot in his or her own neighborhood? It's kind of wacky. That said, what I would do is I'd allow it in a certain area to see how it works for a while. I'm really big on test things out a little bit and keep the pressure on to change the policy so they're much more modernized, so we actually reduce the amount of people actually looking for parking spots.
That's a good idea. Joan, what's your reaction to Haystack coming into Boston?
My reaction is, does it work on Newbury Street when I have an appointment to get my roots colored? I'm kind of on the mayor's side on this one, too. And I just wonder two things. Doesn't this create another situation between the haves and the have-nots, the people who can afford to pay extra to get the parking space? And what happens if...
Not to mention to get the smartphone, to get the app, and all of that stuff.
Right. This hasn't happened to me in a while, but I have on occasion in my past gotten into fights with people over parking spots.
I can't imagine that.
And I just wonder, I'm much more mellow now, but I just wonder, what if two people are still fighting over the same spot and are willing to pay for it? How does that play out?
Now, on the other hand, after saying I'm going to take the mayor's side on this, the city already contracts with other private companies to manage meters, garages, other logistics around parking. So isn't it already sort of privatized anyway, Joan? Why not Haystack?
I guess so, but when it's the mayor's idea, it's a good idea. When it's someone else's idea, it's not.
I think it's different. You're talking about allocation of scarce public resources rather than the delivery of a public service. This is not a public service, right? The public's not getting any money out of this.
Yes.
So those are very distinct things, I think.
Yeah. So I think the great conclusion here is what the city needs is a broader conversation about how it manages street parking, and that's obviously going to come down the road, or needs to come down the road.
Another issue that's been in the news this week is the BRA, and the mayor actually had some praise for the BRA. He attended the groundbreaking of a condo building in the South End, and here's what he said about the Boston Redevelopment Authority.
You know, we talk about the growth of Boston, and really, this time last year, the growth in Boston was about $1.2 to $1.5 billion from the BRA as far as approvals and moving forward in the city. And this year, we've almost doubled those efforts.
So again, some praise, but overall, not a great week for the BRA because there was an audit that found that the Boston Redevelopment Authority lacks financial controls and that failing is costing the city millions of dollars in countless affordable housing units. The audit found the city is owed more than $4 million in unpaid lease payments from developers that basically just aren't being chased down. And then on top of that, the auditors say the BRA is sitting on parking lots around the city valued at more than $3 million and getting zero revenue dollars from them. So, Jim, to you first. What do we do here to make the BRA better if this audit is accurate?
The audit is accurate. This is one of the worst-kept secrets around Boston. And praise to the mayor for actually calling in KPMG to do the audit in the first place, and frankly, for also taking away $20 million for affordable housing from them, right? This is, for the longest time, the Menino administration, not to criticize too much there, but there were all these mitigation payments associated with developments that would go into affordable housing. We don't even know where that money went. That is a huge problem for us in terms of transparency. And what I would say is the good news here is that the fellow, Brian Golden, who's the acting director, is big on reform there. I think he has the right ideas in mind. He's actually come out and said this is unbelievable for a city of Boston's stature, and he's absolutely right. Operationally, in terms of management of money, professionalism, there's a lot to do there.
Both of you, Jim and Joe, know that during the mayor's race, the BRA was a big issue. You know, whether it should be totally blown up, redesigned, complaints from some people that projects were being rubber stamped without appropriate review. This is a whole nother element of criticism about the BRA. Do you think, Joan, that this sort of creates a new level of public sort of political will to change the agency? Is this going to advance that conversation?
Well, it's a problem unto itself. And I think it's, you mentioned the magic word, Menino. That's another, it's another delicate line for Mayor Walsh to walk because this is a real problem. You say it's a worst kept secret in the city. I'd heard hints of it. I didn't know the details, but how he needs to address it. But then no one at the moment wants to pile on the former mayor for a whole variety of reasons.
Hmm. Do the two of you have suggestions for how the BRA can be better? What is the fix?
Well, I think the first fix is that you want to make sure you have control over your money and you have transparency in terms of how you're making decisions. I don't think many neighborhoods, for all the good work that BRA has done, it has done some really great work, neighborhoods don't feel involved in this process whatsoever. And there's a woman named Shirley Kressel who's an activist in the city, and she can be kind of harsh and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to some degree, she's been proven kind of right.
All right.
Can I have one suggestion here? They talk about the use of legal pads. I would say it's time to go computer at the BRA.
Yeah, no more paper records.
All right. Well, it's time now for our hubbubs, those stories that caught the eye of our panelists but perhaps fell below the fold. Let's go to you, Jim, first. What's your hubbub for this week?
I have a summertime hubbub. And, the state is moving to an all-tolling system for Tobin Bridge and the Turnpike. And right now it's doing for the Tobin Bridge. And this is just another reason to
go. This is all electronic, right?
All electronic.
Yeah, you don't have to stop and actually pay the toll.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just another reason to go to the Cape, which is because right now if you don't have your Easy Pass, what happens is they're going to take pictures of your license plate and thank you. They're going to send you the bill directly to your house. There's no escape.
There's no escape. So run to the Cape, you're saying.
Run to the Cape.
Right. They'll find you there, too. I think it's hopeless. Joan, how about your hubbub?
I have a political hubbub that was probably above the fold in New Hampshire, but I didn't read that much about it in Massachusetts. It involves Scott Brown, a reporter for The Guardian, which is a British paper, chased him down in New Hampshire, and Scott Brown ran away from him, didn't want to answer his questions, and ended up in the bathroom. And dodged him for the rest of the day. I had sort of a personal reaction to that story just because he didn't run away into a bathroom, but at one point he was at a homeless shelter in Roxbury. I happened to be the only reporter there. I went to ask him a question afterwards, and he ran, jumped into his car, slammed the door in my face, and said, "See you later." So I kind of had a bit of connection with that poor British reporter.
So my hubbub this Sasha. Week is somewhat summertime-related, Jim, sort of pigtailing on yours, which is that I happened to notice on Twitter this afternoon a tweet that went out from someone, I don't know who this is, it's the hashtag, or not, the handle is Jay Goodell, and it said, "According to Shaw's, summer is officially over. plants are replaced with firewood. And that tweet was accompanied by a photo that showed the sidewalk outside a Shaw's grocery store with tree stumps piled up for sale and plastic-wrapped bundles of logs on the sidewalk. So it really did look like it was giving you an opportunity to pile up sort of wood for the fall fireplace. And I thought, here we finally have a beautiful, dry, sunny day, and already the New Englanders are preparing for another harsh winter.
Couldn't they have at least gone to mom's?
Exactly.
Well, summer's half over, so winter's right around the corner, right? Okay, well, so here's my hubbub. It's about that greatest contest ever we face as human beings, the battle of man against machine. In this case, sneakers against the creaking rails of the Green Line. So does everyone remember those images of Boston Marathon champion Rita Jeptu outrunning a Green Line trolley? And sort of that led to all kinds of cynical remarks like, you know, we always knew we could run faster, make it faster than the Green Line. Well, next Friday, there's going to be a group of runners who will answer that question definitively that occurs to lots of commuters. Could I run faster than the train? They'll race a Green Line train between Boston College and Blandford Street, where the T goes underground. That's a distance of about 4 miles, 17 stops. The T should take about 26 minutes. So that means if you can keep a pace of a 6.5 minute mile, you should have no problem. And if you don't want to run it, you can watch all this online from the comfort of your office chair or maybe even on your smartphone while riding the T itself. You can check out the hashtag OutRunTheT on Twitter. Anyway, I like that story.
That is our Week in the Review for the week. With us has been Jim Sturgis of the Pioneer Institute and Joan Vinocchi of the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Coming up, the new president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, Barbara Mattaloni, talks with us about teaching, testing, and the future of the classroom. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.